The folk dwell in remote and secret places, and celebrate foul mysteries on savage hills. Nothing have they in common with men save the face, and the customs of humanity are wholly strange to them, and they hate the sun. They hiss rather than speak. Their voices are harsh and not to be heard without fear.
And well, first it reminded me of Mimic, because you said they had the faces of men. Then that reminded me of the little dudes.
Little dudes.
Little teeth-eating fairies.
That is from Arthur Macon's novel of the Black Seal. Macon. I'm never really sure how to pronounce his name. I'll say Macon.
Macon.
He was mentioned, an author who was mentioned by name in the movie Don't Be Afraid of the Dark. Mm-hmm. But I chose that selection because it's indicative of the influence that Arthur Macon's work had on the writing of this story. A strange movie.
Great movie, though.
That we watched. That was not directed
by Del Toro.
No, it was not. It was instead directed by...
Why would I know?
Because you've had a week. You could have looked it up. I don't know. Maybe you've been exploring. It was directed by Troy Nixie, a comic book illustrator.
Right.
Canadian.
His only movie.
He did one short film before this. And he says that he has a screenplay that he's going to make into a movie. It's been years. Hopefully we'll see it at some point.
Yep.
He says it's closer to his original short film than to this. It's more set in the world of monsters and
good
creatures.
Good.
Gerwins. So we have a lot to talk about in this short amount of time. Not a lot of time. We have not a lot of time to talk about stuff and a lot to talk about. Because this is, even though it's not a Del Toro film, it's kind of an important film.
I mean, it's kind of a Del Toro film.
It's kind of a Del Toro
film. He wrote
it. He did. He passed it off, though, to Troy Nixie. He declined to direct it. There's a little bit of history here. But before we get into this little bit of history here...
You go first.
I suddenly got all stuck.
I'm Phil.
Wait, how do we start it off? Welcome back to...
No, you say I'm Phil and then I say I'm Ollie.
Oh, yes, that's right. But before we get it started, I'm Phil.
And I'm Ollie.
And it's Del Toro time. When isn't it ever Del Toro time?
When we're not making this podcast.
Yes, it's always Del Toro time in this house.
Mm-hmm.
Surrounded by ghouls and ghosts of the invisible variety.
We have two tiger statues.
We do have two tiger statues. It's our own mini At Home with Monsters. At Home with Tigers. And a snooty greyhound. So, we're trying. We try to live inside our world that we've created.
You've created.
Well, speaking of living inside a world, speaking of invisible worlds and being surrounded by monsters, perhaps without knowing it, what movie did we watch?
Don't Be Afraid of the Dark.
2011's Don't Be Afraid of the Dark. Actually,
that was 2010.
Well, it's weird. It was originally released in 2010, like at a film festival, and then it got pushed back until 2011. So it was ready to be released in 2010.
On the internet, it says it was released in 2010.
Right. But it wasn't released, wide release, until 2011. Yeah. So I think of it as a 2011 film, even though you're right. It was ready to go. There was this... I mean, if you remember Mimic,
yes.
You mentioned it earlier, all the problems that Guillermo del Toro had with Miramax.
Uh-huh.
Miramax was owned by Disney. It was like all part of the same company. Del Toro hated working with Miramax. He hated working with Bob and Harvey Weinstein.
Uh-huh.
And then there was a split. Miramax split from Disney. And so that was... They had made Don't Be Afraid of the Dark. It was... No one was really sure like who owned it for a while. If it had stayed with Miramax, there was a chance that it would have just been chopped to heck. And happily it was not. But by the time it got made, Del Toro was ready to let someone else take the reins. And Troy Nixie had directed a short film called Latchkey's Lament, which is, I've only seen it in severely bootleggy, degraded form. I hate to say this, but it's the only way I could find it. It is a bizarre short film about two keys.
Mm-hmm.
Who are married,
mm-hmm.
and one of them gets destroyed by a monster It's a very strange film. But he made it. He showed it to Del Toro and said, hey, what do you think of this movie? And Del Toro was like, I like it. Do you want to direct Don't Be Afraid of the Dark, a major motion picture? And Troy Nixie was like, okay. But what do you think of that? How do you think it turned out for the product of a first time?
I think it went really well.
Yeah, it's surprisingly... it sounds insulting to say surprisingly coherent, but making a coherent film isn't exactly the most easy thing in the world.
Especially when it's your first.
And I read interviews with the two of them on how they collaborated. And it sounds like, you know, Del Toro was like, I'm here if you need me. And if you don't need me, do what you do. And so he did. So it's as much a Troy Nixie film as a Del Toro film, but it was really Del Toro's passion project.
Until he passed it on.
I think that's part of it, though. Yeah. Like, I think you have like a thing that you care so much about, and after a while you're like, I'm ready to let someone else take the reins. Mm-hmm. Like, give this to somebody else to do.
Don't do that until you're sure that you won't be upset if it doesn't turn out the way you want it to.
Well, it's appropriate because he took the 1973 made-for-TV movie, Don't Be Afraid of the Dark, mm-hmm. and sort of made it his own. So it's kind of appropriate to pass it on again to someone else.
Yeah.
Like, because it's already... You're already taking someone else's project.
Mm-hmm.
I just kind of like, I think it's poetic, like the way it kind of boom, boom, boom. So the original Don't Be Afraid of the Dark, 1973, Kim Darby starred in it, and it was in sort of this like magical heyday of horror made for television, which we get now, I guess, now that it's the golden age of television and like all these great horror TV shows are out. But there was this time when like you would make a TV movie and people would be like, I'm very excited to see this TV movie. Then it kind of like fell apart. Now when you think of TV movies, you think of like Hallmark Hall of Fame TV movies. These like cheapy, like just pump them out, whatever. But these were well-respected entries into the world of horror.
Mm-hmm.
Del Toro saw it when he was young and it always stuck with him. So, wow, there's just a whole lot to cover here. And I'm a little bit overwhelmed. let's just jump in and talk about the movie first.
Okay.
And we can talk about influences and stuff as we go along, because it's an intense film.
Mm-hmm.
And what's it about?
It's about this little girl named Sally,
mm-hmm.
right?
That's her
name. Yeah. Who was, I don't know how to say.
Abandoned?
Basically abandoned by her mother, to go live with her father and her new stepmother.
His girlfriend.
In this giant house that her father and his girlfriend were renovating.
Yeah.
Or refurbishing or whatever.
I say renovating, yeah, because it's a busted up old mansion.
Yeah. But that's not where this movie starts. Oh no. Oh no, that's not where this movie starts.
Describe this wonderful first scene to us. It's a gem.
Well, so the movie opens up to a maid cleaning a room in the house, and there's a bell that gets rung, like, to call the maid down. So she goes down to her employer?
It's her employer. It's the guy who runs the house. It's the basement, into the basement.
Into the basement, opens the door and is like, do you need something? And there she gets no answer, so she walks down a little further and is about to go back upstairs when the voice calls out, something.
Yeah, like, he says her name. He calls her down.
And she's like, okay. And this man appears, looks really pretty normal, but there's like dirty, disgusting things everywhere in the basement. So the maid walks down the stairs, and she trips and falls. She's tripped and falls on a tripwire.
Yeah. Like, it's there.
It's there. So she gets knocked out for a few, or stunned or something. And the man drags her over and rips out her teeth.
Well, you don't see him rip out her teeth. You see him put a chisel against her teeth and raise the hammer, which is the scraping of the chisel on her teeth, and you get this nice little Foley effect. It's like on her teeth when he does it, just when he's trying to position it. And of course she wakes up.
Mm-hmm.
And starts screaming. And then it cuts. There's a discretion shot, a cutaway.
Yeah.
To him
opening this little door.
Mm-hmm.
This little like oven door kind of thing.
It's a grate.
It's a grate. And placing this thing of teeth.
Not just her teeth.
His teeth.
Yeah.
Because he's shown her that he's taken his teeth up at this point.
Yeah.
And says, just give me back my son. And find out that this man is a
Blackwood.
Blackwood.
Who is he saying, give me back my son to, though?
These little things in the vent that we don't get to see yet.
Yeah. These voices.
Mm-hmm. And they're like, your son's down here.
Yeah.
Come to us.
Yeah, but they're not happy with what he's offering them.
No.
Because what do they want?
Children's teeth.
They want children's teeth, and he does not have children's teeth. And they are so angry that they do what?
They taunt him down into the vent and pull him in.
Yep. Because they make him think that his son's there. Mm-hmm. He reaches down and they nab him.
Yep.
And that's the beginning of Don't Be Afraid of the Dark. Oh, and we didn't mention this is the first scene takes place like turn of the century, like 100 years ago.
Yeah.
So then, so like you said, so Sally is modern time, like 2010. Mm-hmm. And Sally's just like, how old is she again?
She's like eight.
Eight, nine, yeah.
I think it's eight because she said she was eight.
She's like this 8-year-old girl. She's cute as a button. She's going to live with her father and his girlfriend in this huge mansion they're renovating, like you said.
Not really her choice.
Yeah, there's a cantankerous old caretaker who lives there. And it's beautiful. It's in New England. Mm-hmm. It's an American set story. Her mother is played by Katie Holmes. Her father is played by Guy Pearce. And this was a big deal when this came out. Because Katie Holmes had kind of been away from the public eye for a little while.
Yeah.
Because of her marriage to Tom Cruise. Speaking of like the unseen world and strange creatures, Tom Cruise had spirited her away to his realm. She was not allowed out. So this was like the first like sighting of Katie Holmes we had in a while. It's a big deal.
Tom Cruise is in a new movie now.
He's always in new movies. He got to do whatever he wanted to do. Mm-hmm. Always. Because he's Tom Cruise. He's not of the human race.
Look like he's aged at all.
He's of the fae folk. I know. Don't ever accept any food from Tom Cruise. He'll be trapped in his world forever. So you get the idea that Sally has a really weird relationship with her mom. Mm-hmm. There's like troubles in paradise where she's from.
You get this feeling she hasn't seen her dad in like years.
Yeah, like, but she's also like troubled. Like she shows up, like there's something wrong with this. Like she's on Adderall.
Okay. I don't know if she's on Adderall for any particular reason, though, because we don't really get to find out.
Yeah.
Like, I think she has anxiety because of the breakup between her parents.
Yeah.
But I don't know if she necessarily needs to be on the Adderall, and I think that might be what's causing some of the problems. Right.
We know that she's on Adderall. She's not allowed to eat gluten. Seems like she comes from a home with a very controlling mother. But it also sounds, there's a really weird phone call. She makes a phone call in secret to her mother, and you can tell the mother's, like, at a party and, like, just has no time for her.
And just really doesn't care.
So you assume that maybe her mother's just medicating her to keep her just out of her hair. Like, it's weird. Like, you don't get to know the mother at all. Like, except for,
but you know the mom's a bad word.
And because, she sent Sally here with basically making Sally think that she was just visiting her dad.
Yeah.
But
Sally walked in on her mom packing all of her clothes and just sent her to live with her dad.
Yeah, she was being sent to live with her dad. Her dad thought that Sally knew this on arrival, but she didn't. Yeah. And Sally's not too happy about Kim, the Katie Holmes character.
No. I was happy about Kim.
Overall, you get this sense that this is a troubled little girl. Mm-hmm. You know that she didn't have friends in school. She never really got along with other kids.
Yeah.
She's very isolated, which is important. That's part of the whole like thing that happens with the fairy folk. Mm-hmm. She's a vulnerable kid.
Yeah.
But
my teeth hurt now.
Yeah, you don't think about the teeth too much. It's a really weird, the original Don't Be Afraid of the Dark had nothing to do with teeth. This one's all about teeth.
Well, I mean, it's a Del Toro written film.
Yeah, and that's one of those things that just everyone just like cringes and they think about teeth things. So this house is on like a huge lawn. It's a beautiful piece of land. Mm-hmm. Oh, they're renovating it. This is supposed to like the father. It's one of those weird things where like the father keeps talking about like, I gotta get this deal and like, I gotta close this thing and like,
my career has to get back on track.
Right. But you're not really sure. Like, what are you? Like, are you a designer?
I think he's an architect.
Is he an architect?
Yeah. I'm pretty sure he says he was an architect at some point.
Yeah. Like at some point, it's got very vague, which mm-hmm. I think is probably intentional because you're kind of seeing this from a child's perspective. So like the world of adults is kind of vague and whatever. Yeah.
But Kim is an interior designer, I'm pretty sure.
Yeah, and an artist.
Yeah.
And so they're renovating this mansion that was the Blackwood Mansion. It was the mansion we saw at the beginning, obviously. And Blackwood was an artist himself. He mm-hmm. was a wildlife artist. He was kind of like Audubon, the guy who did all the pictures of birds.
Yeah, Kim looks really like looks up to him a lot.
Yeah, he's like this like sort of like guy who you don't get much of a history from him until later on in the movie. But mm-hmm. even then, like you assume that he disappeared.
Yeah,
they don't ever. I don't think they actually say that though. Like you don't really know what a lot that happened between the prologue and now. Like it's kind of vague. Even
I mean, I think that's the point though.
Yeah. Someone boarded up the...
It was the grandfather.
The grandfather of the... So, yeah. So, there's this creepy, cantankerous...
He's not creepy.
Character. Well, the first time you meet him, you know there's something... The first time I ever saw this movie, I thought he was a bad guy. Because he was just, like, very stern and always staring at the girl.
Like, I assumed he was just... He knew. I was yeah. like, he knows.
Well, yeah. So, you... He's always warning her away from... warning Sally away from... Like, don't run around on this land.
Yeah.
And Sally, of course, does.
Because she's eight.
Because she's eight.
And
she's
has nothing else to do.
Bored out of her mind.
Because her dad isn't spending any time with her.
Yeah, her dad's kind of a weirdo jerk all through this.
Okay, but you have to like think about it. Because I'm sure, I think that Sally was just raised with her mom.
Yeah.
Like, so I don't know if he's used to having kids around.
Yeah, I don't think he knows her very well.
Yeah, and... Like, he wasn't expecting to have the burden of telling her that she wasn't going to see her mom right. again.
You don't get the sense that he resents her, but you do get the sense that he's just not ready to have a child
yeah.
in his life.
And neither is Kim.
Yeah, but Kim's trying.
Yeah.
Like, Kim is, well, we said that we've talked about this, is she's mm-hmm. an inversion of the wicked stepmother trope. Like, yes. She's trying to be the good stepmother. And
She fails first off the bat when she buys this terrifying teddy bear.
What does this terrifying teddy bear say?
I love you.
But like in this like horrible tin can high-pitched voice, like this like,
I love you. I love you.
And you're like, oh no. Like you don't want to, why would you do that? I don't understand. Like I get symbolically that like the bear is supposed to represent like the artificiality of mm-hmm. the expression, like it's, but it's also just a creepy dang toy, except in, especially later when it, yeah. well, later, but so Sally goes a wandering and
finds this, like she goes into this like wooded area,
right,
and finds, she starts digging,
right, well there's, you sort of get the sense, so the night before the things underneath the house woke up mm-hmm. with her arrival.
Yeah.
And you sort of get the sense when she's wandering that they're like calling to her a little bit. There's a fairy ring too.
Mm-hmm.
A mushroom fairy ring on the yeah. ground, which I thought was going to come into play, but doesn't come into play.
I think it did come into play though, because it was right before she discovered the thing and it was right when they started talking to her again.
Yeah.
And then, I think it was just meant to symbolize that, oh, these are fairies, not creepy gremlin things.
I think you're right on the money there. I think that it's a shorthand of just saying we're dealing with the other world, not with just monsters.
Yeah.
And also they also show the handyman Harris, is that his name, Mr. Harris? They show Mr. Harris trod on it when he's dragging her away.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought that was going to be because when you break a fairy ring, isn't that like a big deal? Or is it?
I think it's a big deal. It's complicated.
I mean, I guess it depends on which like tradition you're dealing
with. Yeah, which type of fairy you're dealing with.
What country,
I thought that symbolized like the end of her communication with them at that point.
Mm-hmm. Hmm.
Like that, the spell was broken.
Yeah.
Because when she walked through the fairy ring, that's when she started noticing like the stuff.
And interesting.
When the fairy ring was destroyed, she was being dragged away.
Yeah. I think introducing this as fairy, which is of course the crux of the story, is fascinating because it allows you to get away with a few things that you wouldn't be able to get away with in a typical like Gremlins type movie
mm-hmm.
or even just a magic type movie. Because fairy is, well, there's a malevolence to it. There's a alienness to it. It encompasses a lot of things. A lot of things that I feel don't get explored a lot in modern culture. I think that
it's because people don't focus on nature anymore.
Well, that's what we're going to get into here. she finds the basement. There's a skylight mm-hmm. that's been buried and covered up. And Mr. Harris is obviously distraught that she's discovered this skylight.
Why he didn't like cover in concrete.
Right.
Do something else.
He grew some plants over it, but he didn't like just board it up completely. But there's a hidden basement. and it's the basement we saw at the beginning of the movie, but it's been artfully disguised behind the grand staircase.
And somehow they have the key to it.
Yeah, it was just one of the keys, wasn't it? Like, mm-hmm. that came with the house. But it's got a beautiful door.
It's a beautiful basement.
Yeah, it's this beautifully ornate door. Again, it's very Del Toro-y. It's this portal into the underworld, which mm-hmm. itself is a portal into the underworld.
Yep.
There's a below the below.
The fairy world, I think you mean.
Yes. And so they go down. They find the fireplace, the ash pit. And it's been totally sealed up. It is like, mm-hmm. it's got a huge metal thing over it with big screws. And it's got runes written over the top.
It does?
Yes.
Oh, I didn't notice those.
Yeah, they don't ever call attention to them. But there's runes written above it, scratched into the stone, that spell out, be afraid.
How did you find that out?
You have to do some reading. You have to do some reading on the internet. But that they say, be afraid. And
why didn't they just write "Be afraid" then?
Well, I don't know who wrote them. I assume that it was Blackwood because it was his house.
Thought it was the grandfather.
Or maybe why would he write in runes?
I don't know. Maybe it was other fairies.
Well, speaking of fairies, Sally opens up. She unscrews the screws.
Well, first we have to get to the part where he's like, "Sally cannot be down here."
Yeah, yeah. Like Mr. Harris is like adamant about like. Stay out of this basement, mm-hmm. Which they discover is Blackwood's studio.
Yeah, and Kim gets very excited.
Yeah, because it's all of his stuff like that's been missing
in
the house. He was this artist, and he's got all of his art down there. But Sally wants to explore this grate because these creatures are basically like, they're calling to her, like they're whispering to her, Sally, we'll be your friend. Come play with us. And, you know, that's that fairy thing. And so I think that them being fairies gives them that sort of like
power over people.
Like there's a little bit of charm there, like calling her to them. Mm-hmm. So when.
Because any normal person would be like, goodbye.
I am out of this forever. So she lets them out. Like they get out.
First, she sneaks a bunch of stuff into her bag.
Yeah.
And Kim's like, do you want to come bake cookies with me? And so I was like, no.
No. Nine. No, no cookies. But she. She opens this grate up, and they immediately are just, like, causing mischief in the house. Mm-hmm. Like, they steal the dad's razor.
She doesn't immediately open the grate.
Well, she leaves one of the screws.
Yeah,
they undo it.
The dad comes down first.
Mm-hmm, and he interrupts her.
And then almost gets stabbed in the ear.
In the ear. She has a pokey stick that they pulled into the grate. And then when he's listening at the grate, they try to poke him in the ear with a pokey stick.
Which happens twice in this movie.
And it's, you know, near miss that first time. But you can tell right away these things are malevolent. Like, they're in no way, well, obviously from the first scene, you know they're malevolent, but they're in no way trying to disguise the fact that these are malevolent little beasties. And they steal the dad's straight razor, his Sweeney Todd razor, and they slice up Kim's clothes. They're basically loose in the house now. Once mm-hmm. she lets them out, they're loose in the house. They travel through the vents.
Yeah.
From room to room. Yeah, and they're kind of like... They taunt Sally in a weird way. Like, they don't know. I am confused. Okay. I'm confused as to what they honestly want in this movie. Because
they want her teeth.
They want, obviously, they want Sally's teeth. They want children's teeth. I don't understand why they don't just sneak into her room and kill her.
There might be, well, they have that contract with the humans.
Okay. So. It still is weird. Like, I'm not sure what their end game is. Like,
first they try and get her to come down on her by herself.
Okay.
So they don't have, like, the adults finding out.
Right.
Which is what I think they're trying to do. I think they're trying to cover their tracks.
Okay.
And I think that when she doesn't comply, they get frustrated and angry because they're so hungry. Because they haven't eaten in, what, like a century?
Yeah.
And I think that they do try and kill her quite a few times, but they don't succeed because Sally's like, this has taken a turn for the worst. I'm telling people.
Yeah, because they sneak into her room at night and they like manipulate the teddy bear so it says, I love you. And they're like moving its arms and legs, which she's initially delighted by. But it quickly goes off the rails. Like, mm-hmm. she's quickly freaked out by these things. I guess it's like, they are trying to charm a child, but they don't know how to. Like, they can't help but be creepy because they're not people. Like, they don't understand people.
Yeah. Oh, and we forgot about the spinning light.
Yeah, there's a...
Which might be why they can't get close to her.
Yeah, there's this night light that's like a giant carousel that the dad sets up by her bed, which is bright and plays a creepy tune.
And is horrifying.
It is horrifying.
And why would you give that
to your child? It's like a haunted toy. Well, like you said, it obviously keeps them away from her bed while it's on, because you learn that they are...
They can't be in the light.
Yeah, they hate the light. It's too much for their little eyes. They're underground creatures.
Mm-hmm.
And they've also gnawed the mouth off of her dolly. She has a doll, and it disappears, and it ends up under her bed.
With it's a Barbie doll.
With its mouth gnawed off, which is a gruesome scene. Like, it's just a doll, but... To see, like, the mouth chewed off of a face is bizarre. And I'm always like, is this a warning? Like, were they just...
foreshadowing.
Were they just trying to, like, eat the... Like, did they think there were teeth in there? Did they...
Well, they don't eat adult teeth anyways.
They do, though. And that's the weird thing. So they make it clear in... So there's a book. We'll talk about the book a little later. Mm-hmm. But there's a book that deals with these creatures. And they do eat teeth. They'll eat bone. They have developed a taste for children's teeth. I think they get the most nutrients or something from it. But suffice to say, Sally is freaked out by these things, mm-hmm. like pretty quickly. Like they don't have a friend.
She's
in
not
Sally.
Dumb.
Yeah, she's nobody's fool. One thing though is she finds the plate of teeth down mm-hmm. when she's first exploring down there, when she first opens the grate.
Yeah.
And she brings one of the teeth up with her.
Two of them.
Two of them. One gets taken away by the dad because that's disgusting. What are you doing with these old teeth? And she puts the other one under her pillow.
Mm-hmm.
And when she awakes the next morning...
There's an old, like, Celtic coin.
There's just an old coin under her. Yeah.
Like or was it a Viking coin?
I'm not really sure which one it was. But it was a very old... An old coin.
An old silver coin.
Yeah, like the Tooth Fairy.
That's probably worth about $10,000 at this point.
Right. So there's this... bit this that comes right on. Her parents or her dad leaves the house with Kim, and Sally goes down into the basement, but she's caught by Mr. Harris,
mm-hmm.
who ushers her out.
Tries to, anyways.
But, well, he does, because she leaves out of the basement.
Yeah.
But then he's down there, and the creatures come out. He starts trying to put the cover back on the ash pit.
Yeah. And they're already out.
Yeah, he gets attacked by the little mans.
And he's like, I didn't tell them about you. I didn't tell them about you.
Right.
We had a deal, blah, blah, blah.
Yeah, and they attack him, and they attack him, and they attack him.
And it's awful.
It's brutal. They attack him with his tools,
mm-hmm.
his little razor, like his like X-Acto knife, scissors.
And now they just have all these weapons available to them.
Yep, they sneak into his bag and get all of his weapons or his tools. And it's like this thing where they're just like, cutting away at him. Like, and then they stab him in the shoulder.
And he gets upstairs.
Yeah, but he does make it out. He does not get killed. He gets taken to hospital. And
Sally has seen all of this at this point.
Sally saw it happen. Well, she didn't see it happen, but she saw the result of this man who's been sliced to ribbons with tools sticking out of him. They're like, I guess he fell.
He fell into a pit of tools.
He fell into a pit of goblins and then stabbed him repeatedly with his own tools.
And Sally's like, he did not fall.
Yeah, but he gets sent away, and it's...
And there's this nice, like, maid who's like, oh, God, I tried to cover her eyes, but
I couldn't. Yeah, there's a housekeeper who's not really a character much.
Like, but she's like the sweet old granny.
Yeah, she's like a sweet old woman who lives there. She disappears, like, she exits the movie at some point.
She's probably like, I'm out of here.
Right, she catches a cab, drives her away from the movie. Sally's getting more and more worked up about this. She's starting to talk about these creatures, about being afraid of the dark, about mm-hmm. not wanting to, you know, go to sleep at night, wanting her parent or her dad or Kim to be in the room with her.
Not really her dad. It's more right. Kim.
Well, she's the nice one. And they call a therapist.
Her dad gets really upset at her.
Yeah. This therapist comes, says that she's, you know, like having like, she's stressed out. She's created all this stuff in her mind. These vivid, like.
She's drawn pictures realities. Of the creatures yep. now.
Oh, yeah, because Sally's quite the artist.
She is an amazing artist. Yeah. I wish I could draw that well.
She's a really good artist, and she's drawn pictures of these creatures, which freak everyone out because they are horrible, mm-hmm. horrifying. The therapist is like, I'm going to prescribe her some
antidepressants.
Some dopey meds. Well, I thought it was sleeping.
It's sleeping pills, yeah.
Yeah, so she can sleep, Which sounds like a great plan. But Kim is starting to believe Sally. Especially after, well, she visits Harris in the hospital.
Yes.
Who is not bandaged.
It's been like a week since the incident, by right. the way.
And she goes to visit Harris, and he's still bloody. Like,
he's still bleeding everywhere.
He's in bandages that are soaked through with blood in a hospital bed.
His black eye hasn't healed at all.
His face is still like with fresh wounds all over it. There's like blood on the wounds. It was the one part of the movie I was like, did no one tend to this guy? Like, he looks like he's just been laying in his own filth for like a week, and he's in a hospital. He's not like hooked up to anything. He's just laying in a bed. But Kim goes and talks to him. He tells her to go to the library and look up Lot something or other.
Lot something or other.
A lot number that is all of Blackwood's hidden stuff.
Like artwork and stuff like that.
Yeah. So she goes, and that's where we meet handsome librarian.
Never comes back.
Cute young man.
Really smart.
Really smart, knows all about this stuff. But she finds out some stuff about Lord Blackwood. What does she discover?
His drawings of the creatures.
Which look...
exactly like Sally's.
Right. This is where we start talking about Arthur Machen, or Arthur Machen, and Algernon Blackwood.
Arthur Bacon.
Love that. Arthur Bacon. You know who loves Arthur Bacon? Doc Jones. Doc Jones loves Arthur Bacon.
If we ever meet any of these people, they're going to hate us.
Arthur Macon's long dead. Doesn't matter. So let's talk a little bit about... So they bring up the works of Arthur Machen, Arthur Machen. Again, I don't know his name.
Arthur Bacon.
Because explicitly mention him. And his work was kind of the inspiration for the direction that Del Toro went with this story. Again, mm-hmm. the stuff with tooth fairies and things like that was not in the original teleplay. In the original TV movie, they were just...
It was in Hellboy 2.
Right. They were just goblins. And this is where you start seeing the parallels, the stuff he was working on with Hellboy 2, how this stuff bled into Hellboy 2, how Hellboy 2 bled into this. So Arthur Machen... he wrote books and stories. He wrote The Great God Pan, The Three Imposters, which contained the novel The Black Seal, The White People. His whole focus, I mean, obviously it changed from story to story, but mm-hmm. part of his deal is that if you develop the ability to see beyond the veil,
yeah.
To the world of fairy, mm-hmm. you are done for. You're doomed. He believed in the malevolence of fairy, of little people. And when I say he believed, he may very well have believed that this was an actual thing. In his stories, the creatures of fairy are these, they don't care about our world. They have their own rules. They're what is called, I think it's blue and orange morality, which is they follow a line of morality that is ineffable. Like, it's not good and evil. It's something that we don't understand.
Wow, that sounds a lot like humans with animals.
Right. But it's that thing. Their brains aren't like ours. Their psyches aren't like ours.
Well, yeah, they're fairy.
Right. But they're intelligent, and they mm-hmm. can communicate and speak our language if they want to. But they don't make any sense. And knowing them will always lead to our downfall. To insanity, to death, to... bodily distortion, dismemberment, things like that.
I hope I never see a fairy.
Not a good thing to be.
Tinkerbell, stay away from me.
And then Algernon Blackwood was an author who wrote two of his things, The Wendigo, The Willows. His whole thing was, hey, I mean, he wrote a bunch of other stuff too. He wrote ghost stories, things like that. Mm-hmm. But he was like, hey, let's go out in nature, but don't appreciate it too much or it'll kill you. But first, it'll drive you mad. Like, you will be stuck in the middle of nowhere, and when you wake up, the trees will be in different places. Or someone will disappear from your campsite, and you'll just hear them screaming from 100 feet up in the air all night about how their feet are on fire. Like, and then when they return,
relatable.
Their feet will have been burned to cinders. And then they'll disappear again and go flying away, saying their feet are on fire. It's, his stuff was very much like, what the heck is going on? I don't understand this at all. What? Because nature itself is operating under its own rules. Mm-hmm. And uh-oh, you stumbled too far in. And so you can see where this influenced Del Toro's take on this. Because mm-hmm. the creatures in the house aren't evil. They're just operating under their own rules.
They just want to eat.
They
haven't eaten for like 100 years.
Yeah, and What do we discover about where these creatures came from? Like, who they are?
They are adults who were dragged into the land of fairy by the creatures.
And turned into
the creatures. The creatures.
And they made a deal back when.
Way back when.
With Pope Sylvester II.
Uh-huh.
So the idea is that they've always existed with us. These creatures steal teeth.
Steal children in the night.
They steal children in the night. They rip the teeth out of your head. Pope Sylvester II said, I'll make a deal with you.
Yeah.
You leave the kids alone who put their teeth under pillows. You leave
leave the Christian kids alone.
Yep.
Everyone else is fair game.
Catholic kids, not just Christian kids. We'll let the Catholics know this is how you protect your kids. And the creatures were like, great, we'll just kill everyone else. Unfortunately, word got out as to how to avoid the creatures. And that's how the Tooth Fairy.
So we have to assume that humans knew about the world of fairy for a long time.
Well, that's the thing. I think that's what they're saying is that.
So they knew about other types of fae creature.
Oh, yeah.
Which is maybe why unicorns and dragons and all that stuff were, like, very prominent in early art.
Well, I think that's mm-hmm. what they're trying to say. And unfortunately, like, everyone else found out about these rules and
the creatures were like, hey.
And it started getting easier and easier to avoid having your children taken away by the creatures. So the creatures, you assume they sort of got driven underground from hunger or something, because it's that weird thing where, like, they can't disobey the deal they made
mm-hmm.
because that's one of those fairy things. Like, contracts are important. Yeah, it's like
the rule that in some cultures that fairies have, if you throw a thing of salt on the ground, fairies have to count each individual grain.
Right.
Like, you can't break that.
Yeah. Or like the whole, like, Rumpelstiltskin thing where mm-hmm. like, if you guess my name, he could have reneged, but he couldn't because that's a fairy rule.
He was a fairy.
Like, that's just the rules are the rules. And I like that the danger of fairy comes from the fact that not that they hate us, but that they are operating on a level that we cannot begin to comprehend.
And there's only little cheap tricks we can do,
right,
to control that danger.
To stave them off.
And we have definitely lost most of those tricks throughout the years.
Now, a lot of the backstory for this is in a book called Don't Be Afraid of the Dark, Emerson Blackwood's Guide to Dangerous Fairies, which was written by Guillermo del Toro and Christopher Golden, the Man of the Hour, one of my favorite.
Did he write one of those alien books?
He definitely did write one of the alien books you love so much.
I remember that.
Christopher Golden, I've mentioned him before. He writes a lot of original work, but he also writes a lot of media tie-in books. Mm-hmm. I discovered him through Hellboy adaptations that he wrote. Just original stories that he wrote. Because I guess there's novelizations, which are, I took this screenplay and I turned it into a novel to sell.
Which is what some of the alien books are.
And then there's media tie-ins, which is, I'm writing more stories within the world of this.
So it's like fan fiction.
Yeah, but official fan fiction. Official fiction.
Official fan fiction.
That's how I discovered his Hellboy stuff. And I was like, this guy's good. Like, I was like, this guy's legitimately good. Like, I really enjoy the way he writes. And so I started pursuing more Christopher Golden stuff. Well, come to find out that he does a lot of stuff with Mike Mignola, who did the original comic of Hellboy. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of crossover between him and Del Toro and Mignola and, like, just, it's this little world. It's this little, like, inner circle of mutual admirers who all like each other's work. And so they sort of, like, go to each other for, like, this, like, collaborative stuff. So, yeah, he co-wrote it with Del Toro, this mm-hmm. whole book that's the history of Emerson Blackwood. It's also, like, an encyclopedia of the fairies he discovers. It's got a lot of pictures in it by film director Troy Nixie, who did the illustrations for it.
I'm getting my own copy of it.
So just a brief overview is that it's set in the 1800s. It tells the story of Emerson Blackwood. He's a wildlife artist, researcher, like we know.
Mm-hmm.
He chronicles the hidden world of fairy. He finds, a colleague of his finds a skeleton of what ends up being one of the monsters from the movie.
Yeah. Do we ever find out what they're called?
Oh, there's all kinds of names for them around the world. But he notices that their bones, the bones of these creatures, are made of dentin, like teeth are built made of, mm-hmm. and that their teeth are like obsidian, and that they're capable, that they have like passageways in them so they can inject acid into whatever they're eating to break it down. And he's like, these things would be capable of eating teeth.
So they're basically cannibals because they're eating what they're made of?
I don't know if that's the case. If you chew on your hair, you're not a cannibal.
That's true, but you're not mostly made of hair.
I mean, you're mostly made of meat, but if you're eating meat, you're not a cannibal.
But you're eating, like...
They don't eat their own teeth.
Well, yeah, obviously, but you're not made of the same stuff that animal meat is made out of.
Kind of are.
Kind of. But if you're made, like, out of teeth, wouldn't that be kind of weird to, like, eat?
They're not made out of teeth.
They're made out of the same stuff that teeth are made out of.
Their bones are made out of that stuff.
Are their bones a part of them?
But our bones are made out of the same stuff that other animals' bones are made out
That's
of.
That's true.
I mean, you can eat bones and bone marrow.
But we don't.
You can eat bone marrow. Bone marrow soup is very popular right now.
It is?
Well, it was like a few years ago. Because it's super rich in nutrients.
That's gross.
It's bone marrow. That's gross. How is it any grosser than eating anything else out of an animal?
I don't actually eat that much meat anymore.
But still, in any case.
Oh, I'm bleeding.
Tooth fairies. So Blackwood's... It goes all over the world, Germany, Japan, Iceland, Russia, America. And he discovers that these creatures are everywhere. And they're known as tooth breakers, milk imps, bloody gums, jilly rot tooth, gnaw bones. Like, they're everywhere. And they're always the same everywhere. Like, there's variations on fairy and all the other countries, but these things are pretty consistent mm-hmm. wherever he goes. He ends up marrying the daughter of Professor Eichmann, who's his partner. Professor Eichmann gets killed mysteriously. He thinks it's by these creatures. He ends up getting on their bad side, trying to flee them, discovers he cannot flee them no matter how far he runs. They recognize him even in America. He discovers one of their mounds. He desperately wants to study them still, maybe make a deal with them. He builds his house over their mound. They start demanding children's teeth. He's like, I can't do that. First, they kill his wife by ripping out all of her teeth.
How would that kill her?
Well, I guess and killing her. I don't know. But he finds her body. Then they steal his son away. He still can't bring himself to kill any children to give them the teeth. And that's...
Which is not a bad thing necessarily.
Right. He's not a bad man. He just made some bad decisions. And he that's where the movie begins. It begins with his final attempt to placate the monsters. And this is where you start getting the idea that these monsters, they must be fairy because they recognize him even in America, even though he's crossed oceans. He knows that their warrens run underground, but they must also run under the ocean, or there are gateways to other worlds within their warrens. Like, there's something magic going on.
But we did find out that they were taken across the seas by the Vikings.
Right. We find out that the Vikings had made deals with him in the past to protect their own children from them, but that deal went bad, and there was like this mass slaughter of the creatures. They, like, in the book, they find mass graves of children with all their teeth. Like, it's a pretty grim. They set fire to one of their dens at one point to try to destroy them. Like, it's a pretty intense little book. Plus, it has like all these like listings of like Baba Yaga and Boggarts and Kappas and Onis and mermaids, like all these other creatures, and kind of how they tie into this whole mythology. So firmly within the world of Don't Be Afraid of the Dark exist all fairy creatures. Like, anything in folklore exists.
Good or bad.
Right. It's there. And
actually, we don't know if any good ones are there because it wasn't documented.
Well, we do know that there are good ones. In the book, he mentions that he's only documenting the bad ones. There are ones that don't mean us any harm. Like, there's ones that he can't figure out how to get them to hurt us. Because a lot of these are just like, they don't care about us, but if you stumble and cross them, they're going to smoosh you or whatever. So yeah, he moves to America, and that's not enough to get away from them. And but the big thing about them, and the what I wanted to point out beyond all this, is that in this world, the way this setup is, the fairy world is a byproduct of God's creation, is how it's set up here. And God was like, I like you guys, but you're not really part of this, so you don't have to obey my laws. You don't have to obey God's laws or man's laws. You're on your own. And that's when fairies develop their own alien morality.
That seems really dumb.
On God's part. You guys have all these superpowers. You don't have to do it. You don't have to worry about me.
You can kill as many people as you want.
Go right ahead. It's that weird, like, God logic, I guess. Like, man, you think fairies are hard to understand.
Try understanding God.
Try to wrap your head around a divine being. You're not going to do it.
No. Unless God is him, is in itself a fairy.
Is God a fairy? Probably not. I don't think that's the way it works in this.
What if he is, though?
What if God was one of us? Just a slob like one of us. Just a stranger on the bus.
What if you are God?
Trying to make his way home. Just like the Pope may be in Rome. Nobody calling that? On the phone. I'm sorry you were not alive in the 1990s and did not experience the wonderful works of Joan Osborne and her one hit, Got One of Us. What if God was one? You don't remember that song? No, because you weren't alive in 1996? Probably not. It's a terrible song. I did learn how to sign language it once, though, from a woman I dated in college. She was like, I'll teach you how to sign One of Us by Joan Osborne. And I did. Probably the greatest thing I ever did in college. In any case.
We haven't finished summarizing the movie yet.
Yeah, I know. But we got to that book. So Kim figures out what's going on.
Yeah. She tries to explain it to the father. Do we ever learn the father's name?
Alex. His name is
his
Alex.
His name is Alex. Yes. Okay. And Alex is having none of it.
But he is having a dinner party.
He is. It's after all of this weird ass stuff happens, he's still like, I'm gonna have a dinner party.
And he invites, it's to seal the deal. Mm-hmm. He's gonna close the deal with the guy. That's really all we know about him. There's a big important guy coming. Sally is flipped out, but Kim gives her a flash camera, mm-hmm. an old Instamatic. And it's like, if you're afraid, here's a flash camera. If you see the monsters, I guess flash them with the camera. And
don't use a flashlight or a phone that we obviously had at this time.
Right, it's still modern times, but she only has access to this old flash camera, which has an infinite number of flashes, by the way.
Which makes no sense.
It's not how they work. But in any case. So Sally's running around the party taking pictures. She sees the Gerblins.
All the adults are like, oh, cute kid photographer.
Yeah, she's just running out taking pictures. Mm-hmm. The Goblins are there. She keeps taking pictures of them to keep them away.
They're not having it.
Yeah, they steal a photo of hers. She sees them under the table. She chases them out of the room into the library.
And the dad makes a sarcastic comment.
Yeah.
And
Kim, she didn't like the menu.
Kim gets up. Kim's in her room right now.
Right. Kim's like not having any of it.
Yeah. She's packing up Sally's stuff.
Yeah. She wants to get Sally out of this house. Sally gets trapped in the library with the monsters who start attacking her again.
Mm-hmm. Grab her camera.
Yep.
She kills one of them.
She kills one of them, cuts its arm right off. Doesn't come into play. She never shows the arm to anyone.
No. She just has this arm lying around. Why did you pick it up and be like, here's the evidence
that
I have. She
also has dozens of photos of these things. But so they destroy this library, and the people come bursting in when they hear Sally screaming. The Gerblins are gone, but one of their arms is there. Again, doesn't matter. She doesn't show it to anyone. But it does, I guess, ruin the deal. I don't know if it ruins the deal. We never really find out.
No, like the guy's just like, okay, I think we should leave. Like, your daughter seems to be in distress.
Yeah.
We'll come back later.
Well, here's where things get weird. So finally, Alex is like, all right, let's get her out of this house. She ran away at one point. Do you remember that?
Yeah, she ran away, and Alex was having none of it.
Yeah, like, she ran away from home. They brought her back. Finally, Alex is like, let's fine. Let's get her out of this house soon, I guess. First, we'll knock her out with sleeping pills and put her to bed and then leave her alone. Like, it's this really weird, like, why are you, just get her out of the, just get in the car and go, like, while everyone else is leaving, just leave. In any case, they start trying to leave. Alex gets knocked out in the
garage
by the monsters and locked in the garage with a running car, which mm-hmm. is bad.
Bad.
Sally starts getting dragged down to the basement by her
she feet. Trips on the same tripwire. Kim trips.
Kim trips on the tripwire and is knocked out.
Kind of.
Yeah, knocked woozy. Sally starts getting dragged down to the basement.
She lost her camera.
Mm-hmm. By her ankles. By the monsters. Mm-hmm. Not by her. I mean, the ankles.
The ankles turned against her.
The monsters have grabbed her by the ankles by a rope and are dragging her down. Kim falls
like
down the stairs.
Like that scene in the story about the giant where the people are, there's the human that walks into like the land of fairy or something and they think he's a giant. So they tie him down and start dragging him to their village.
Like Gulliver?
I don't remember what it's called.
I think you may be referring to Gulliver. Gulliver's Travels. He gets tied down by the little people.
Yeah.
Yes. He also meets horse-headed people. But no one ever dramatizes that story.
Probably because they don't care.
They're called like the Winnie
the Poohs. Yeah.
In any case, Kim severely hurts her leg. It gets a big gash cut in it, like down to the bone when she falls. And it's hard to look at. She tries to rescue Sally down in the basement. The monsters are trying to drag her into the...
She's cutting away while she's being stabbed by the creatures as well.
Right. So it's this weird thing where the creatures have gone down into the ash pit. They're pulling the rope to pull Sally down. Kim gets between the ash pit and Sally and is cutting the rope. But she gets the rope twisted around her leg while she's cutting. And she's like, when I finish cutting, you run. She cuts. The rope gets pulled taut. Tell us about what happens to poor Kim's leg.
It like inverts.
They break the leg. It pulls it in half. With a noise. For a movie that has gore, but not wall-to-wall gore.
Yeah.
This is one of the most unsettling things I've seen in a major motion picture. Like,
we have to talk about the dad before we continue this, though.
Oh, yes.
So the dad wakes up in this garage, and he's like, oh, snaps. I am in a garage with a running car. Let me... run around for like a maniac for like 30 seconds while I'm slowly suffocating to death when there's a glass window and a bunch of tools I can use to break it around me.
He eventually does break the glass window.
Finally.
But they cut his hand and it makes it hard for him to get out. But
and then he goes.
Oh yeah, and they've also pulled the electricity. They've blacked out the house.
It's which is dark. Smart on their part.
Right.
And he gets out, goes, peeks through this door hole, and oh boy, what happens? Oh boy.
They finally get their pokey on him. Oh god. They don't poke him in the eye or anything, just in the face, but it looks painful.
And I looked away.
Yeah, he looks through the keyhole.
Which is dumb.
Which is dumb because
just open the door.
Nothing good ever comes from looking through keyholes in a monster.
If you just slammed the door open, you would have killed them.
Right. So he runs down to try to save them. Just as Kim is being pulled by the monster mash into the ash pit.
She gets pulled in.
She comes back up. We think, Kim. And then she gets pulled all the way back down.
Yeah. And he goes and he's like, Kim.
Kim. And there's like, ah. And it's all terrible. And then
he turns around, looks at his daughter, scoops her up, and they get out.
They get out. Smash cut to an unspecified amount of time later.
Mm-hmm.
They return to the house.
Yeah. Because Sally has drawn a picture for Kim.
Mm-hmm.
And he's like, they enter the house. They walk like a foot in. He's like, this is good enough. And they put the picture down on the ground and they leave.
They leave. The picture flies through the house.
On magic fairy wind.
To the grate, which is again all sealed up.
Mm-hmm.
It gets sucked into the grate. And that's when you hear the voices of the creatures saying, you know, like, what are we going to do? Like, will people ever, when are they going to come back? When are people going to come back?
They'll always return.
And you hear a voice say that people will forget. That others will come, and that they have all the time in the world. But whose voice is it?
It's Kim's.
It's Kim's voice. And that's so, and then that's the end of the movie. Kim has been turned into one of the things. The weird thing about the movie is that there's a lot of weird things. The main goblin is, and I only know this from reading other things, is the main goblin is supposed to be Blackwood being turned into the goblin. But you're never given any indication of that. Like, you didn't know until I mentioned it.
I assume, like, if you paid close enough attention to the voice, like...
I have watched this movie several times. And I'm like, nope. Like, there's not enough indications.
And, like, none of their voices are any different from each other, so why is Kim's?
She still sounds like Kim at the end. But even Blackwood, you only hear him say, like, two or three things.
Yeah.
Like, he doesn't say anything to indicate... that I'm Blackwood. I mean, maybe like there's a little hair around the ears, but again, and you only see Blackwood for a minute, like in the very beginning, and then you see these monsters.
Mm-hmm. Would Kim's creature have red hair?
I don't know. Would it be tall like Kim?
She's not that tall.
She's not young. She's old. Oh, I mean, by the way, there's a whole bathtub scene we left out.
Yeah.
Where they give Sally a bath, and you're like, don't leave the child alone in a bathroom because the monsters attack in the dark.
And there's that cool key scene we left out where they slide the paper under to get the key.
Which is from the original version. Yeah, you poke the key to the keyhole, and you put the paper under it, and you pull it out. There's a lot of little moments like that throughout the film.
Which is why we don't use skeleton keys anymore, my friends.
And because we're afraid of skeletons. So
we all have a skeleton inside of us.
Isn't that the worst?
Or are we inside the skeleton?
No, it's definitely inside of us. What if the earth is just the bones of a skeleton?
What are we then? The flesh?
Yep.
We are the flesh of the skeleton.
We're skin men. We are the skeleton skin men.
We can talk about the brain later.
So my thing is, so it's kind of vague that that's supposed to be Blackwood.
Mm-hmm.
So in the original TV movie, the storyline is fairly simple. The great Sally in the original movie was just a woman. There's no Kim character. She's an adult. Basically the same as the kid, except that she does get pulled into the grave at the end. Sally's grandmother has died and left them this house. The thing was sealed up after Sally's grandfather disappeared.
You would think that the grandmother would be like, I'm not going to leave anybody this house. Have it demolished after I die.
There is a Mr. Harris who's like in charge and gets attacked by the monsters. But the rule is just, it's very simple. It's just these monsters are sealed up in the grate. Whoever lets them out has forfeited their life, will be sucked into the grate with them, and becomes the next monster.
Mm-hmm.
That's it. There's no tooth fairy or anything, which is kind of what makes this whole movie a little confusing. Because you're like, they're after two things then. They're after replacements for themselves, and they're after teeth. They don't...
Well, are they after replacements for themselves in this movie?
Well, there are, I guess...
Because it seems like the adults are coming in by accident.
I guess it's like, do they recreate new creatures from the teeth? Like, do they take you, since you don't ever know how they turn a person into one of them, like, you're just sort of left up to the imagination. Like, what do they do? Like, what is this weird process? Like, are they so small because it's our teeth that are turned into the bones of these creatures? And then
that would make sense.
But then we get mooshed, and they just moosh all of our organs into, like, the meat?
That would make sense, which would make them cannibals.
But we don't know that, and they seem to kill some people, but then turn some people.
They only turn people who fall into the grate.
But they brought the little boy down there.
Yeah.
We don't know if the little boy got turned into...
No, I think he was killed for his teeth. I'm pretty sure that they don't turn children.
Okay.
I think they were mimicking his voice.
Uh-huh.
Because we would have... If he had been one of the creatures, we would have seen.
Yeah, I just feel like it's a little shaky. Like, there's a little...
Well, I mean, like, what else were they... Like, they can't, like, fit all this lore into the movie.
I guess that's what the book is for. The book doesn't even really go into it that much about, like, them turning people into the monsters.
Maybe they don't even turn people into the monsters.
Maybe they do not.
Maybe that was just some other actress. Or maybe that was some other creature that was voiced by Katie Holmes.
One of the creatures was voiced by Guillermo del Toro.
Our favorite man.
So we got that going for us. I don't know. I don't think it's a perfect movie, but I think it sets up a human relationship with the world of fairy far better than Hellboy 2 did for me.
Yeah. Well, I mean, was it really a human relationship in Hellboy 2?
Well, you know what I mean. Like, mm-hmm. Hellboy 2 tried to do the thing with, like, fairy exists, it's a world outside of our world. But since the fairies in that world were so human-like, like with Prince Nuada and Prince Nuala, like, they're just like people.
Yes, both of them are princes, definitely.
You know what I mean? They're both just people.
Well, we only really got to interact with the elves and the, like, ogres in that movie. We didn't get to interact with any of the others. Like, we saw the little dudes with, like, the split heads, and they did not seem human.
But I guess, like, what I'm saying is, that even when you're watching the Goblin Market, and you get the sense that these animals, these creatures, these characters, all are just—they're kind of just people.
Yeah.
Like they're monsters. They're like Star Wars characters.
Mm-hmm.
Like, they all have the same. They all understand each other. We could talk to them.
I think it's also part of the fact that, like, they've been shoved underground by the humans.
Yeah.
And they don't hunt us.
Right.
So they've had to kind of conform and, like, adapt right. to the way humans have gone.
And I think I like the notion, the more Arthur Macken style, the don't be afraid of the dark approach, which is fairies could never do that.
Yeah.
Like, they cannot do that. They could never truly be like us because they will only sow chaos wherever they go.
Mm-hmm.
They're so powerful and so otherworldly. That's what happens in The Great God Pan, Arthur Macken's Great God Pan. This young woman gets this experiment done on her where the part of her brain is removed and it allows her to see into the world of fairy.
That's dumb.
And she gets pregnant, has a child. The girl grows up into a woman who basically drives people insane and infects the world with the world of fairy. At wherever she goes, people are driven mad. She kills people just because she's this otherworldly creature.
Wait, how did she become did she get pregnant with a fairy baby?
Yeah, they never really say, but you assume that it's like the child of
a fairy
or the child of the concept of fairy. Like, it's so bizarre. But yeah, so she just sows chaos wherever she goes. And
does she like intend to, or?
You don't know, because she's not much of a character.
So like, it's all about this woman.
But of course it's, you know, told by men. So I'm sure there are stories that tell it from her perspective. I'm sure she's got something to say. But again, like, that's the idea, is that once you've made contact,
you are part of this.
You're part of it, and you are dooming us all.
Yeah.
Like, these worlds should not mix. They should not mingle. And if you had done a Hellboy like that, where, like, they're like, no, you don't understand. You cannot associate with these creatures. You're Hellboy. You're a demon. But even you won't be able to, like, fathom their minds because you're too human.
And it, like, would have been interesting with the Princess Nuala thing and Abe, like, he falls in love with her, but she's like, what?
Yeah, I don't know. I understand, like, that's not how the world of Hellboy functions. Mm-hmm. Like, it, as set up by Mike Mignola or anything, like, there, it is a very human-oriented, very, like, unfathomable.
I mean, like, it kind of has to be.
Yeah, it kind of has to be to tell the stories.
Yeah.
And it's not horror. It's fantasy, urban fantasy. But this is closer to horror, and when you want to tell good horror with fairies, you make them as creepy and alien as possible.
Which is what they would be. They're not humans. They're not little naked women with wings.
No, they're not. Those are pixies, and they're not as nice as we always think they are.
Just read the Harry Potter series.
Yeah, it's... So the movie came out... I mean, it got fine reviews. A lot of people thought it was somewhat derivative. A lot of people thought it was... I just don't think people knew what to make of it. It's not... Once you introduce fairy into a story,
especially a horror story,
it warps people's expectations. And I think they were like, is this supposed to be scary? Is it gory? Is it, are these monsters? Are they,
have to be a super nerd to understand the story.
Yeah, I think it fell out of people's comfort zones.
Which is what a good story does.
Yeah. Roger Ebert liked it. He thought it was frustrating and charming, and a good haunted house film, he called it. It only has an average rating of 5.8 out of 10, so you can see where people were just kind of like middle of the road about it. I'm not really sure.
Some people were like, this is great, and other people were like, I don't know what's happening.
Yeah, it didn't make as big an impact, I think, as they were hoping. It made back its budget, but it wasn't a hit.
Which is a shame.
Really good. I think it is. I think it's a very good movie. I think it has hidden depths. I think surface wise, it's a little like, okay, like, this is weird. But that if you start looking at what Del Toro was doing, if you start reading between the lines, like, this is a story within a greater universe.
Yeah.
Like, this is just one thing that happened with these creatures. I think it works. I think it's a little uncomfortable fit, just because he took a pre-existing tale and added this to it,
mm-hmm.
kind of like he did with Hellboy 2. Like, he was like trying to like graft his own ideas onto a pre-existing property. But the little girl, what's her name? Bailey Madison, who played Sally, is great.
She was awesome.
Yeah, she's a fantastic actress.
Mm-hmm.
Again, Katie Holmes is really good in it. Like, she's a very likable character. You really want her to succeed.
She doesn't succeed. Well, she does succeed. This is a story that doesn't really have a success. Right. In it.
It's a sad ending. Guy Pearce is fine as the father. It's a solid little film.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's a solid film. I think it's worth picking up. I think Don't Be Afraid of the Dark, Blackwood's Guide to Dangerous Fairies is totally worth picking up.
Mm-hmm.
If you get a chance. It's a great bit of tie-in material. Christopher Golden for the win. Check out Christopher Golden's other works, including his Alien novel, his Hellboy stuff, his original writings. I've read so much of his stuff, and of course I can't name any off the top of my head. I love Christopher Golden. He's just a fun writer. He has young adult stuff that he's written. He's prolific, and he seems like a charming guy to work with. Troy Nixie, like I said, we said at the beginning, he seems to be working on a film right now.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know anything about it.
Check out his comics. Works.
Yep, check out his comics. He's done a lot of great stuff. He's collaborated with Neil Gaiman. He's done stuff for DC. He's everywhere. You'll recognize his stuff when you see it. He's great. He seems like a very nice guy. Guillermo del Toro, check out his stuff. He seems like a good guy. He seems like a good person to work with.
Even though our favorite man, Ron Perlman, didn't make it into this movie, check out his stuff. He's also a great man.
There's so much stuff we didn't even mention about this. Like, we didn't really touch on the great bathtub scene. We didn't talk about the mural she finds in the basement. Like the painting that was done.
We didn't talk about Sally's interactions with her father.
Right. We didn't talk about the fact that this was actually co-written. It was Guillermo del Toro and Matthew Robbins. Matthew Robbins stepped in to work on this screenplay with Guillermo del Toro, those two would go on to write the screenplay for the unproduced At the Mountains of Madness that Guillermo del Toro worked on for years.
That I really want to see.
Until Prometheus came out and shattered all hope of that ever getting made, because it was basically the same story. I don't know, there's a lot going on with Don't Be Afraid of the Dark. I think it's worth a look. I have friends who don't care for it. I have friends who are kind of meh on it, but I think it's definitely worth a look. And even mention this, even though it's a Del Toro-y film, if you look at Troy Nixie's work and you look at this movie, it's a Troy Nixie film. And I think one of the reasons it gets lumped in with Del Toro, besides the fact that it is very much a Del Toro movie, is the fact that Troy Nixie is a very visual director.
Yes.
And a visual stylist. And when someone has that big a vision, it's just easy to go, wow, this guy's got a vision too. Like, he's just like this other guy with a vision. And I think that he loves Del Toro's work. There's a reason he sent Del Toro a copy of his short film, mm-hmm. like, originally. Like, he's very influenced by him. So, I said, it's that whole, like, Christopher Golden-y, Mike Mignola, like, they all intertwine. They all influence each other's works. And I think that's cool, like, that artists work like that.
Yeah. They don't work like that on the internet. They just insult each other on the internet.
They draw Sonic fan art. So our next movie that we've got coming up in line was going to be I'm a Big Robot.
Oh, what's it called?
Pacific Rim. You can see I was doing a big robot. That's our next movie, Pacific Rim.
You said it was going to be our next movie. What happened?
What? I did?
Yeah, you said the movie that was going to be our next movie was Pacific Rim.
Oh, I don't think I meant to say it like that. It's going to be our next movie.
Yay!
Pacific Rim. We'll be watching it, getting that out as soon as possible. So, anything else you want to add?
No.
All right. Well, until next time, I am Phil.
And I'm Ollie.
And, no, wait. And it's not currently. It's the end of it. So, I'm Phil.
And I'm Ollie.
And we'll see you next time when
it's Del Toro time.